Okay, so my name is Savannah. I am 15 years old. Today is the, what's the date today?
24th.
Today is the 24th of November, 2018, and I'm speaking with my grandpa, Adolf Speck. And we are recording in Whitewater, Wisconsin. So the first question, Grandpa, can you tell me one of your happiest memories?
Kind of positive. Well, one of my happiest memories is when I sold in a Cessna 150 when I was in college.
All right, so the next question, also on the topic of positivity, are there any positive moments or memories from your life that you think shaped you into who you are today? Are there any negative events or memories that you think shaped you into who you are?
A tough question from students that I had decades ago. It's always teaching is one of those things you never really know what your effect on students has been because so much of that takes place later on in their lives, and then to hear from them at some point later on is pretty significant.
That is really cool. So that's very positive. Anything negative?
I think from a negative disappointment thing was I always wanted to be a career officer in the military from as early as I can remember. And I went to Purdue to pursue that and an engineering degree. And I wasn't able to continue with that. It was a 4-year program, and I was interviewing for the third and fourth year. But because of my medical history, they said, no, you can't do it. And so that was probably one of the most devastating things as a kid.
Yeah, I would imagine.
And but it took me to all, to so many other places because of it.
That is really, it's really interesting because something that seems so like devastating can end up having a positive effect in the long run because it causes so many other things that wouldn't have happened.
And one of those things is that I went, I changed schools because I didn't want to be around the ROTC if I couldn't be in it. So I transferred schools, and that's where I became interested in, I was always interested in flying, but where I joined the Flying Huskies and ultimately got my pilot certificate. And that was always a really an important thing for me.
Yeah, that's really interesting, Grandpa.
Parents
Your parents?
were, without a doubt, two of the strongest influences in my life. My dad was first generation Czech. His dad came from Czechoslovakia, or from Bohemia, actually. And he was very strict, but his expectations were high. He's a very, very kind man. Never got a spanking from him, but I would never ever think of crossing him because I didn't want to disappoint either one of them. I never, he didn't live long enough for me to ever really say that we became friends, which I think is something that happens as you get older, you change relationships. But it was something that happened with my mom. And for that, I'm always just grateful for that. Very giving woman, very demanding woman, stubborn, which is probably where I get my stubbornness too.
It's probably where my mom got her stubbornness.
Could be. She was just, as I look back now, be like an ultimate mom. She cooked, she cleaned, she sewed, she shopped, she gave us piano lessons, she was in the PTA, she worked for the Red Feather, which was like a community organization. She helped at voting booths, you know, for all that kind of stuff, and she was very, very she was demanding, and yet on the other hand, if I were to come to her with a story about something that just bothered me about another person, one of the first things she would almost always say is, "Well, you just don't know what has happened in their life that made them that way, or you don't know what their day was like." And so she was always gave people the benefit of the doubt as to, you know, what their actions were like at that time that I was commenting about. And I think those are significant.
I would agree. They seem like fantastic people. Of the people you've lost in your life, who do you miss the most, and what about them is it that, or what is it about them that you miss?
I probably miss my mom the most.
Yeah.
For that reason of friendship.
Mm-hmm.
And after my dad passed away, she absolutely blossomed. She continued to travel on her own, even though they did together as husband and wife. He died in Rome while they were on a vacation in Europe. So when she came back, she learned how to drive. She was going to school. I think she even went to school when Dad was alive. But if she would travel somewhere, she would try to find a university course that would cover either that particular country or that geographical area and the things that went on at that time. So she continued to be an inspiration to me my entire life. And a thing about becoming a friend, I would talk to her probably 3 times a week, maybe more. No, I would just call her up.
Mm-hmm.
And when she died, it was really, it took a while to get used to the fact that, boy, I want to go call mom. You see how she's doing that? I know.
Yeah.
Can't do that.
Can't quite do that.
Yeah. So, yeah, that was a big hole. That was a big hole. And for a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
She touched an awful lot of people.
It sounds like it. This one's it's a lot lighter. Can you tell me about the dumbest thing you ever did in your life?
I probably wouldn't want to tell you the dumbest thing I did. Huh. Let me put that on pause. My dad thought it was a dumb stunt. I had, my first car was a 1952 Buick Roadmaster.
Let me repeat the question. Not sure I said it on the recording. Dumbest thing he's ever done. Okay, go ahead.
Okay. So this was not a dumb thing in my estimation, but in my father's it was, so we'll categorize it that way.
That counts.
So I was driving my 1952 Buick Roadmaster, which was the first car I owned. And when I would come home from work in the winter when the streets were icy, because there were not many cars on a block, you know, not every family even had a car, much less 2 cars and 3 cars as you see today. So when I would be going home, I would be heading south on 59th Avenue. And in order for me to park, I would have to be heading north, which means I could pull into a driveway and then back up and do a 3-point. But when the streets were slick, I could just hit the brakes and then really hit the gas, and I could spin this huge car all the way around. So it would went 180 degrees and would end up right against the curb, just a perfect parking job. And I was so proud of the fact that I could do that until one day my dad was looking out the window and he wasn't really happy about that. So that was kind of a dumb stunt. I mean, I'm sure I did a whole lot of other dumb things. Probably just forgot them.
I think that's a good one. I think it qualifies. Can you tell me about your grandparents or your great-grandparents?
From a personal standpoint?
Mm-hmm.
I knew three of my grandparents. I knew my grandma Spec. That's my dad's mom, of course. His dad or my grandfather died about a year before I was born. So I never got to know him. But I knew Grandma Speck, and she was raised in Chicago. And they lived next door to George Halas of the Chicago Bear fame, you know, the owner.
Mm-hmm.
And her brother played sandlot football with George Halas as kids.
Wow.
They're over on Wood Street in Chicago. She was a seamstress. She loved to quilt. She loved to bake bread. I remember those kinds of things. Get a call that Grandma's bread was done, and they were two blocks away. She lived with my aunt and uncle. And I spent a lot of time over there. But I didn't get to know her as an adult, and I wish I had.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, there again, you start seeing people in a different light. She was very kind, and she was funny. She was good at imitating voices. She was good at telling stories. And she would babysit us every once in a while when Mom and Dad would go out, which was not very often because Dad was extremely busy with all the things that he did.
Mm-hmm.
On my mom's side, the Novitsky side, that was Grandma and Grandpa. Novitsky. And my grandfather was born in Lithuania. And the story that we were given is that he did not want to serve in a Russian army. So he escaped from Lithuania to come to the United States. And the story was that he had paid one of the border guards to shoot at him to look as though it was an authentic try to stop him from escaping.
Mm-hmm.
And he came to the United States and became a coal miner. And he and his brother had become, I guess, small contractors. They had some crew members and they had some machinery. And the story was that Grandpa always went to work, and they would work 12 to 16 hours a day, if you can imagine. But one day he did not feel well, and he didn't go to the mine, and that was a day that there was a cave-in, and it buried all his equipment and his crew that day. And he left the mining business, and they went from Monoy City, Pennsylvania, to New York. I'm trying to think of the name of the town. Boonville, New York. So he became a dairy farmer there, and then he moved to Chicago. I didn't know him very well. They lived in Wheaton, Illinois. We lived in Cicero, Illinois. And back then, a 20-mile drive was a long way.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what it was. It was, you know, something around 20 miles to get to their house. And he had a small farm. They had very little money. And I remember him as being a very quiet man, not a very well man. He had a black lung from coal miners. You know, they got that lung disease. I remember his tractor that he had. I remember every fall that we would go and handpick corn. Instead of what you see today with the corn pickers that they have.
Mm-hmm.
And then he came and he and Grandma both moved from Wheaton to our house in Illinois, or in Cicero, because he had become very, very sick and he was no longer able to be cared for at his place.
Mm-hmm.
So. And that is where he died. He died on Maundy Thursday when I was a sophomore in high school. I remember that very vividly. And that was the first time I lost a close family member. I had had, you know, like just an uncle that died, and for him to have died in the house that day, that was significant.
Yeah. I would imagine. It seems like something that would stick out.
And Grandma was very rough around the edges, as you would call. And she also loved to quilt. Now, she did cross-stitch quilt.
Mm-hmm.
She liked to cook, and she would make beet soup, which was one of my favorites. And she always would call me Sonny Boy. You know, Sonny Boy. But she was very loving, and yet not as you would normally think that to be.
Mm-hmm.
She would give you a hug, and she would give you a kiss. But it was, as I look back, you know, very affectionate. But my two sets of grandparents, had I known both sets, were very different. There was definitely a city situation versus a rural bringing up. The Novitskys had a very, very rough life. Very rough life.
Yeah. Very interesting.
How did that work?
That was pretty good.
Yeah.
That's, I think, is actually so interesting. Like, that was very interesting to me, listening about all of their different histories and, like, their backgrounds. So, that was...
My grandpa Sveck came from Bohemia with 50 cents and a violin. That was what he had. He became very successful. You know, he had his own orchestra. They played on the radio, the Bohemian Hour. So every week, you know, they would have their program, and my dad and my grandfather both would be playing, and we'd have to sit at the table in the kitchen and listen. And Grandma would say, "Can you hear?" And me and my mom, Grandma, would say, "Listen, you know, that's your father playing saxophone." And it was pretty exciting. I've never been able to find any thing out of all the old radio program and so on, anything about that particular show. And whether there's a copy anywhere, I have no idea. We have pictures of his orchestra in the studio, but that's it.
That's really cool, Grandpa.
Yeah.
I'm learning so much about you and your family. How has your life been different than how you imagined it would be when you were young? Which we kind of talked about a little bit earlier with what you originally were going to school for, but then it didn't quite work out. But is there anything else?
I think that didn't work out at the time was my getting a military experience like I hoped I would have had. And decades later, back in 1980, a friend of mine, Gary Peterson, who was a fellow teacher at the school I was at in Barrington, said, "Hey, Sveck," he says, "I just got a thing in the mail about a program that they're running in the Navy called APG, was Advanced Pay Grade. And what they were doing is they were trying to improve the military by taking some of the people who were out in the civilian world doing the same thing that they were doing in the Navy." I think that's kind of how that went. And so they would give them credit over and above what the normal track would have been had you just joined the Navy flat out. Yeah, so the APG program, and I had just finished going to school up in Kenosha, and I got my Federal Aviation Agency mechanics license. And he says, "Hey, Sveck," he said, you're interested in airplanes, and you just finished up school. He says, "Why don't you go over there and check?" So I went to Glenview Naval Air Station. And I took the test, and I had every, I got all the questions right, and the guy that gave me the test, he said, had you ever thought about becoming a flight engineer? And I said, no, I hadn't. In fact, you know, I didn't tell him that I had been turned down by the Air Force, you know, to be in service. And I swore that day that I would never ever tell anybody about my past medical history, so I didn't. So I joined the Navy in 1980 and became part of a flight crew on an Orion P-3. There were four engine airplanes that were used for tracking submarines. So in the summer, when we would have our active duty period of 2 weeks, sometimes you would go to school, sometimes you might be at your home station, or on two summers I went to Japan and was flying Navy patrol missions there, just like the regular Navy was at that time, which was during the Cold War. And it was really an eye-opener to see just how precarious everything was in
mm-hmm.
terms of what the world was like. We were flying, trying to locate Russian subs and keep track of them. And they would try to keep track of us, too. The 1 year I was out there was the same year that a Korean airliner was shot down as it went off course and was flying over Russia. And they finally, it was a commercial airliner that they thought was a military, United States military airplane.
Mm-hmm.
So they eventually shot it down because they thought it was not commercial. Anyway, so we were flying in those same waters at the months afterwards. So it got a little dicey, to see, they would send up their interceptors to see what we were doing, and you just never knew. So on one of the flights, we were up in the, we were flying in the Sea of Okhotsk, which is near the Kuril Islands, you could look that up, north of Japan. Above the pilot's head was a red telephone, and every once in a while he would get a call from what we call ASWAC, which is Anti-Submarine Warfare Center. And they said you can expect visitors, meaning that they would send up an interceptor probably to see what we were doing. And that happened to be my first flight up there. And I was kind of spooked. Does this ever bother you? And he says, he says you get used to it. He says you just never make any mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
So, but that whole experience about, flying up there and being in the military as I always wanted to do. I spent 14 years from 1980 to 94, in various capacities. It was one of the greatest things I ever did. A real honor to serve my country. Met so many nice people, excellent people, qualified people. That was a situation that just turned out really well.
Mm-hmm.
That's a long answer, huh?
That was a good answer. So I've asked you a lot of questions, so is there anything you want to ask me that you've never asked me before? You might not have anything, and that's okay.
I would be interested in it. What would you really like to do? What do you think you would want your contribution to be?
Just to the world as a whole.
To the world, to your community, to yourself. At this point in your life, where do you think you want to go? Do you have a long-term path beyond high school, college?
If I was talking about career goals, I'm really interested in being a lawyer. I did a job shadow last year with a few of my friends, so we went to the Jefferson County Courthouse and we shadowed some real lawyers and we had like a mock trial. But just personality wise, or just like me as a person, I just try to be the nicest person I can be and the best person. I always try to be as kind as possible and just a good friend. I want people to trust me and I want people to be comfortable around me. So I always try to be somebody that you can go to, or it's just you always know is there. So I try to just be the best person that I can possibly be, which a lot of people say, but I really try. I actually had a conversation with my friend Nikita once. We're on our way back from a volleyball game, and we were talking about just kind of what was going on in our lives, and just having, it was like one of those deep conversations that you just have. And she told me, she's like, I'm so impressed with how well you know yourself and how you think. And I thought that was so interesting because she's right. Like, I know myself very well. Some people will, like, feel certain ways and they don't necessarily know why, or they don't know how to handle it, or problems will happen and they don't know how to deal with it themselves. And I try to be, like, an independent person and be able to solve those problems myself and know what to do in situations. So I try to always work on those things about myself. So that's a good answer for you.
Isn't it? Well, where does that spirit of independence come from?
Honestly, I don't really know. I think I've been a person that I don't want to rely on people my whole life. There are some people that will live in their parents' basement until they're 23, or they expect everything to be handed to them. And I think I've never wanted to be that person. So I try to do things myself. And also I have people like Asia that I look up to so much. Asia's so independent, and she does everything herself. She has a job. She's going back to school. And even though she's had her lower parts in life, she got back up, and she bettered herself, and that was all on her own. Nobody else could make her do that. So I think people like that and situations and things like that are where that independence comes from.
Then I would ask you this question, that there were a couple of brothers that, I can't remember their names. They're basically a Christian siblings, you know,
mm-hmm.
And they would go around and they would talk to people. And one of the things they would say is that do something that is difficult to do.
Mm-hmm.
Do something that will even require you to go outside of yourself and seek help of others. What do you think of that?
I think I like that. It's because it's important. That is one thing about me that people have noticed. They're like, it's okay to ask for help sometimes. And I am one of those people that sometimes just doesn't want to. I will try and do it myself, no matter how difficult. So I think that's a good quote, or that's a good saying. If something's difficult, go out and try it. Like, if you need help, it's okay. Because I think sometimes I could be reminded of that. It's okay to have help, or it's okay to ask. So
I would say in my own life, and maybe this is a question later on, you know, disappointment things, or things that you should have done.
Mm-hmm.
That's something I still am not good at, asking people for help.
Mm-hmm. I'm the same way.
And the consequence for that many times has been unfinished things.
Mm-hmm.
Because the task that I selected for myself, had I really thought it through, probably would have said, I can't do this by myself.
Mm-hmm.
And I need to have help. Another thing was being too perfect. Try to be too perfect. You know, the thing about perfection is a fine line as to how hard do you try to do something very well, and at what point does it become a burden?
Mm-hmm.
To where, an example for myself is that if it doesn't look the way I wanted it to turn out, I get so disappointed that I quit. Rather than accepting my limitations or getting somebody to help me through and make it the way I wanted it to be.
I definitely get where you're coming from. That is, you and I are very similar, is what I'm learning today.
Yeah, it's a difficult thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's a difficult thing. There's, I guess one of the things, besides doing stuff and accomplishing myself, sometimes it's nice to say, and I would also like to thank, for example, Savannah for helping me,
mm-hmm.
you know, because being able to acknowledge other people and making them feel worthwhile is important too. I mean, there's a lot of joy in that. And great things, for the most part, are seldom done by one person.
That is very true.
How's that for an answer? How are we doing?
Pretty good. This one's not so much of a question, but it's... Sorry, these last couple are kind of about me. So tell me a favorite memory of me. This is a dangerous question.
The favorite memory of you,
mm-hmm.
as in Savannah?
Yep.
Well, let me say... The other night when I talked to you on the phone, it was just for minutes.
Mm-hmm.
You remember when I was talking to your mom?
Yeah, I came downstairs and she
and
called me like I was in trouble.
I thought to myself after I had spoken with you, I thought, what a delightful girl. What a, you know, just, you are so upbeat.
I try.
And I wanted to call you back that night and tell you that. And I didn't. And I don't know if it's because it's too late or I didn't think that. I don't know what I thought.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but I. So I want you to know that.
Well, thank you.
That was nice. It was a. And you always are so articulate when you're on the phone, and I can understand you when I speak, and because my hearing is so degraded,
mm-hmm.
that, you know, when I can really understand somebody, without, what did you say? It's nice. And I never have that problem when you're on the phone, or even in person. I very seldom have to ask you that.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's good. Try to make your life easier.
So that's our, just favorite memory, just seeing you in your uniform, or you playing sports, and I can't put a favorite one. I think you're just a delight for a granddaughter.
Well, thank you, Grandpa. So the last question is, do you have any regrets? So it's going back to you, not me anymore.
Oh, boy.
Where do I begin?
You probably don't have enough time on her.
We've got 11 minutes, almost 12.
Well, some of the regrets are, you look back and say, yeah, I wonder if I was a good enough husband. I wonder if I was a good enough father. I wonder if I was a good enough grandfather. I haven't experienced a great grandfather yet. I wonder if I was as good a teacher as I should have been. Regrets. I find the word regret to be really strong.
Mm-hmm.
Because in that term, and at least in my mind, you almost negate the possibility of personal forgiveness. And I think it's important that as a person that you, as best as you can, forgive yourself for things that you think you did incorrectly or not well enough.
I also hear, like, a lot of people when they talk about regrets, it's not always things that they did, but it's things that they wish they would have done, or they wish they would have tried or said. So it's like the regret of not doing something, if that broadens it at all.
I guess in retrospect, in some I would say I regret the fact that I never completed my engineering degree. I think it was something I was good at. I could have been good at. I never felt particularly smart as a kid.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting that as I met people that I went to school with, as a kid, they said, "Oh, you are so smart," and I never felt that way. And I think that my self-concept was really limiting in what I could do. And yet, there were things that I did very, very well. I regret in a way that I didn't pursue my music until much, much later in life. And, you know, I started playing piano again, basically, when Tanya died. That was my therapy. I started playing piano, you know, 2 and 3 hours a day practice. That was a way for me to keep my head together back then. I think as a youngster, had I practiced that hard, I would have been a pretty crackerjack musician. Yeah. I never, in some regards, I would say I'm sorry that perhaps I didn't travel, but I don't enjoy that. I love home. I love being in the United States. I have no great desire to travel the world,
mm-hmm.
even though I've been in Japan and Korea and the Philippine Islands, the Netherlands, the UK. It was never my desire to pursue those things. You throw France in there too. So, yeah, maybe, you know, limited travel. How are we doing? We need some more yet?
We can be done. We have about 7.5 minutes. We don't have to fill up that whole 45. That's just the limit. Unless you have anything else you'd like to add.
Now, I don't know exactly how it would fit. We're going to be back. I mean, I'm very grateful that I started going to church. As a family, we never did that. As a family, we were never told we couldn't go. My mother had been raised a Catholic, and she used to go to church. My dad, I don't think, ever did. His family ever went to church. But I recall my mom telling me, she says, "You know, if we had been a religious family," she says, "I'm sure that you would have ended up being a preacher or a pastor or something." And it's funny that in later life, that even, you know, as late as about 4 weeks ago, my pastor handed me a pamphlet about going back and getting a degree in the seminary. You know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I find I'm by no means a perfect Christian. I think that what we have been given by Christ is a tremendous gift. I'm glad that I have partaken in what he has to offer us. I enjoy the opportunity to read scripture at church or to play a service, you know, when I can. I'm I think the in my heart that to realize, this is mine, you know, to realize that there's something greater than us that has made all of this possible. And there are right things to do. You know, we live now in a thing where, in a culture where, you know, pretty much it's, you know, all relative as to whether things are right or wrong. You know, I strongly believe that there are right and there are wrong, and it's important to realize that there are those boundaries. I think people that don't often just kind of, you know, float around without a rudder, looking for some moral relativity that will fit. And I think that guideposts are so significant in anybody's life. You know, we get that from our parents, we get it from our teachers, we get it from our coaches. You know, how do you, if you've never played baseball, for example, you could probably teach yourself somehow, but to have a coach put his arm around you and talk to you or yell at you because you aren't doing things right, because if you want to win, you probably aren't going to be in a shade of gray, you know? You're either doing it or you're on the bench kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And there's nothing wrong with that. I think that people have that, those underpinnings are blood. I think it gives them something that a lot of other people search for a long time. So, I don't know. Well, thank you for the interview.
Thank you for letting me interview you. It was very interesting. I'm very happy that I chose you to interview.
Yeah.
Even though at first you said you weren't the best person for it, you had some very cool stories.
Well, you would hope after 76 years you probably...
Maybe have something. One or two.
Yeah, something that would work. But, you know, I have been very blessed. I would say that, you know, on the world stage, I would be one that was born with a silver spoon, as they say, in your mouth. But then you look at my folks. My dad was a principal. My dad was a musician. He played jobs sometimes Friday nights, Saturdays, and Sundays. So that there would be more income for the family. He worked also at that same time frame. We also worked with what were referred to as DPs back then, displaced persons, which were people that had, for the most part, came from Europe, but not all from Europe, you know, from other countries too. And my dad would teach in night school one or two times a week, and he would help these people learn English so that they could pass their citizenship tests, and he really liked that. Yeah. And then he worked at the welfare center, you know. He taught woodshop, and he also worked at the welfare center with their orchestra. And those were all sources of income for our family. You know, and yet with all that, every year we took a family vacation somewhere. It was usually Wisconsin, sometimes Minnesota. And sometimes we'd even go on a spring vacation. So.
Well, I would love to listen more, but we only have 51 seconds remaining.
All right, then.
I think I'm going to end it here. Thank you, Grandpa.
Well, thank you.
Can I put all the tables together?
Yeah.
How'd you do that?
I turned the tables away.